I want to talk about cannabis in Italy.
Yeah.
So you move from different countries to countries, but you were born in Italy and you were born and raised there, right?
Yeah, I was born in Milan, raised from parents from central Italy on the Marche, the Adriatic coast. Yeah, I lived also in France for a little bit. I lived in England for a long bit. Now I'm living in Germany. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in Italy, as I grew up, it was quite accessible. It was quite, like, I was in a circle of friends at school where a few of them had brothers that were a couple of years older than us.
Mm-hmm. How old were you?
So when I started, I was maybe 13 and a half, 14.
Okay, that's early.
Yeah, that's... but you have to consider that in Italy, my father started smoking cigarettes when he was 13 as well.
That's true.
And, you know, maybe that's sort of like the background culturally mm-hmm. of the country. But through this group, it became quite easily accessible because the town we lived in was in between Milan and Switzerland. And Milan was, being a big metropolis, a big modern city, of course, it was easy to find hash. Also, the tolerance levels in Italy were quite high of it.
Mm-hmm. So people don't mind if you smoke?
Not as much as in Bavaria, definitely. I mean, of course, you can't do it in Piazza Duomo in front of the police. They will arrest you, but... Once upon a time, it used to be even more relaxed than it is now. So in Milan, there were some big parks like Parco Sempione or Piazza Vetra, where you could just walk in and walk 50 meters, 100 meters, and you'd be approached by four or five guys, you know, offering to sell you hash, offering to sell you weed. Now it's not like that anymore.
They used to smoke also in courts, right? In the court buildings?
Yeah, I had a group of friends that used to smoke basically around the corner from the big courthouse in Milan, the one that you see on TV. when
But there were police there, right?
Well, the thing is, next to it, like behind this courthouse, there is a high school. So that's why they used to smoke there. The students used to smoke there, and as they grew up, they used to still go to the same place. But during the police is there, you know, to watch the courthouse. Normally, there's maybe one car, and it's a huge building. Otherwise, it's just for the big trials that there's a lot of it. But so in our town, you had this situation where in the south, you had Milan, which was a big city with, you know, let's say medium high tolerance of weed. Mm-hmm. And you had, like, let's say, very good hash, mostly from, you know, North Africa, even some Nepali charas, sort of.
Nice. There's a lot as well. Yeah. Options there.
Got good hash, yeah. And the typical, let's say, easiest to find medium high quality hash was called Super Polline, which was sort of like very yellow, mellow, polline sort of hash. So you had a very good hash situation. The weed, you could find any level, even high quality. But the high quality, sort of like Dutch level quality, was quite expensive. On the other hand, north of our little town, you had Switzerland. And even there in Switzerland at the time, the tolerance level was such that they basically had shops that sold weed legally. Like, the premise of it was, it wasn't a coffee shop. You couldn't smoke inside the place, as in Amsterdam. They sold it with the excuse that it was meant to be for your hot bath, to make it smell nice, or to, not really, or to put it in your wardrobe to keep the moths away. But it was bullshit. Everyone knew. Like, they had a menu with, you know, 8 types of weed, and you could ask which one is the heaviest, and they tell you, like, you know, we've got some really heavy sativa, white widow, blah blah. So this was just half an hour away across the border.
How much did it cost, like, both in Milan and in Switzerland?
Let's say you could find really good Swiss weed that was, let's say, almost Dutch quality for about 10 to 12 gram, then you could find some really good, like, super skunk Amsterdam.
10 euros, you mean, not grams?
Yeah, the equivalent of it, yeah. I mean, you know, 11 euros per gram, 12 euros per gram, something like that. The
equivalent. Yeah, yeah, I know, but yeah. You said 10 grams.
Ah, well.
10 euro per gram.
Yeah, 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 that's what I meant, yeah. Between 10 and 12, you could get medium high.
That's a good price.
Yeah. Then around 15 per gram, there's where you used to get like really heavy, super skunk, like coffee shop level, Amsterdam level. Because Switzerland back then, they were competing in the cannabis cup. They had some of the best plants in the world in Switzerland back then.
Nice.
And that sort of weed in Milan, you could find, but you would pay 20, 25. So like, it would be way more expensive in Milan than it would be in our town, because in our town was basically just half an hour from the border. So between these two situations, let's say we were quite lucky. We had a lot of variety. We had a lot of hookups, both in Milan and in our town. We knew people who went illegally, you know, brought back illegally from Switzerland and sold in Italy. So, you know, sometimes we didn't even buy, we would just go a whole afternoon in Switzerland, you know, 10 or 15 of us, bring a football, bring radios, bring panini, and we would just get high and play football and stay there a whole afternoon and not bring back anything. I made a bomb when I was like 16 from the chemistry lab in school. I stole the glass parts, you know, that they use in chemistry to teach you how to make formulas.
Okay.
I stole like a big bowl of glass like that with three things coming out on top. I stole a big long piece of glass.
Okay.
You know, like a stick.
Yeah.
And I put them together with glue and sticky tape, and like I made a bomb, which was, I called it the Think School. And like every time someone came at my house and smoked it, there was one guy who just couldn't get up from the sofa anymore.
So it worked.
Yeah, but since then, like basically after school ended, I moved to England for university. And while I was in England for university, my parents moved house, changed house. And when I came back to the new house, bong wasn't there anymore.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah.
So, in general, in Italy, there's a lot of smokers, I guess.
Yeah, I think in the culture, generally, I'm not sure why. Maybe because we're a peninsula in the Mediterranean, so we're not that far from North Africa or from the Middle East. I think generally all over Italy, there's a lot of people who smoke. From my generation on, previously I don't know, but from my generation on, you know, among the generation that I grew, I would say at least 30% of the youngsters smoke.
So you can, like, I mean, if you're hanging around with new friends and whatnot, you would be open in Italy to talk about, okay, I smoke weed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely, I would say that not just, I mean, if you increase the, you know, the range to the people who don't smoke, but what do they think about people who smoke, then they don't care. Like, you know, it's among people my age and younger. If you say like, oh, last night I went to this place and we were talking and we had a joint, it doesn't matter. It's like saying, you know, we went to this place
and drank wine.
Yeah, and we had a glass of wine. It's exactly the same. Like,
that's nice.
Doesn't,
because it's not like that in Germany. You can't be really open about it in Germany. But I'm very open about it because I want to, you know, get this message
through. No, it's good what you do. I approve what you do because it's true. I mean, I think stoners need to be sort of like louder and, you know, prouder, almost like black people or gay people.
Yeah, definitely.
Have to fight for their rights. And I think we also have to do the same because, you know, moving here, I experienced one of the toughest environments for stoners in Europe. of all the countries that I mentioned.
Definitely.
I mean, specifically Bavaria, I must say, not Germany. Like in Berlin, in Hamburg, in Frankfurt.
Of course.
In Köln, I have experienced a much higher level of tolerance.
So what do you do in London?
In London, I used to work in advertising. So I was in a big media agency, one of the biggest in the world, buying advertising spots and places. So not the creative development of the ads, more the media placement, the buying strategy. That's what I was doing. And after that, after the media agency, I worked a bit for a tech company, which was a Californian company who had developed their own algorithm to buy online video advertising across every website, every social platform, on mobile.
I have a question about London.
Go on.
How awesome it is to have a weed delivery in London.
It's pretty good, man. It's pretty good, man, because in London, even for food, you have all the best deliveries you can think of. So Italian, Chinese, Japanese, Indian.
Okay, so it's perfect for munchies.
So for eating, you can have every evening something great at home without even going out of your sofa, you know? And then for
like a good, like a really good,
but like food. Restaurant level quality, like, you know.
Okay, so not like a shitty delivery.
Like if you're Italian, as good as you'd make yourself at home, and you have even Asian food of top level, you know, delivered at home, black miso cod, you know, all sorts of stuff there delivered to your doorstep. And weed is the same, man. So like usually, usually if you live in London and, you know, you're a stoner, you end up going to parties, meeting people, and sooner or later, you'll be given a number or you'll crash at somebody's house at 4 a.m. and they'll call their dealer, and basically everyone has a number that you can call and they'll come. Like basically pretty much every day of the week, usually they operate like between 2 p.m. and 2 a.m.
So nice,
not
man.
Too early in the morning, but sometimes you can even catch them around noon if you're lucky. During the week mainly. So you call them, and in England it's really open, even on the phone. I was surprised when I first moved there how they talk about it with the dealer. I mean, in Italy we always had sort of codes, because even though on the street it was quite tolerated, we knew that basically
it's still illegal.
The police could listen in relatively easily. They still needed a judge's warrant, but it was relatively common, and also because of the mafia, you know, that like since years they have been doing even random checks, you know. So we always talked about, like, you know, how many pages do you have to study for the test tomorrow? That meant, you know, how many grams you want, or this sort of, you know, code, you know. Whereas in London, like, the dealers were very open with, like, you know, what do you want? Like, what do you have? Like, yeah, skunk, hash, and, you know, some of them even talked about coke on the phone. Yeah, and so I was quite surprised. They're, like, openly talk about it. And then most of them, you know, the good ones, after you call them within usually half an hour, at most 2 hours if it's a weekend, and if it's like an evening on a weekend, but they'll come and they'll have, you know, Dutch level quality stuff. Mostly these guys will have weed, though. Hash is not that common.
Nice. In London.
Very good hash is not so common in London.
And how much does it cost, though?
So in London, with this sort of like service, of course you have to expect to pay a little bit more because of the service.
Sure, definitely.
So usually they sell little baggies that are pre-made, you know, little plastic baggies they sell for like 40 pounds, English pounds, and it's about,
around 50 euros, 50, 60 euros.
Yeah, and it's about 5 grams. inside in theory, but it's not really an honest 5 grams, you know what I mean? It's kind of light usually, but let's say 5 grams. So in theory it's
a, but can you measure it though?
Well, not really, because
they never said it's 5 grams. They just say, okay, it's a baggie, it's just 40 pounds, yeah, right?
Exactly. And also, like, usually most of the time, like, they'll come to your house and they'll ring, but like, I had mine to come in, you know, like close the door behind them and do the stuff in the house. But most of them meet you in the car. So like, it's not really easy there to like weigh it and check it, because there's people walking around and stuff like that.
Okay, you're right. You know what I mean? That's true.
So, but like in theory, you know, standard, by experience, I would say that's what it is. When you pay 40, it's supposed to be 5 grams equivalent, but it might be a little bit less sometimes. Like, but then what happens is with my one, for example, I used to have deals where I used to buy, you know, 3 baggies at a time, and then I would pay 20 pounds less. So, you know, for 3 baggies, I would pay 100 pounds instead of 120. So there, you know, you have, if you buy a bit more.
Okay, so they're fair.
It works out, yeah. Plus, like this guy, you know, sometimes he would just give you half a baggie as a gift, because, you know, I'd been calling him for years by the, at the end of it, so... I still have his number when I go to London.
Oh, man. you need to give me. You need to give me when I'm going. If I'm going to London, definitely.
Yeah.
And.
But it's. I mean, most people have a guy like that, and it's usually. I mean, it's either that or you have like other places where you can find it. Is like the cabbie shops. So before Uber. And they're still there. They have these little shops which are like mini cab companies. That's not the London Black Cab, not mm-hmm. the official one, but you know, they're usually local based and they drive you, they have cars, you can rent cars. So they're usually, they're open the whole night. They're a good spot to ask for weed. London is such a cosmopolitan city full of people from all over the world that there is a big stoner community too, and I mean it's accepted, it's tolerated. If you go in a big park when it's nice weather and walk around at least half an hour, I mean you'll smell it in the air somehow. And even if you're smoking in the street, like discreetly, you know, as you're walking by, no one really turns around or is shocked, you know. There are whole areas of London where you smell it quite heavily, like if you go in Camden or if you go in Shoreditch on a weekend, it'll be almost hard to avoid, you know. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, basically with the kind of money that's going around in London, I think you will find every kind of drug that you want there.
Yeah, sure. There were, when I was living there was something on TV that came out that like, there was... They found trace levels of cocaine in the Thames River. it's mental. The whole city does so many drugs. I don't know. Like, I heard another estimate of how many tons of cocaine they do per week, and it was mental. Like, there are so many people there that are mega rich.
Definitely, that's why. Like, there's a demand for it.
And there are whole industries that are... high levels of consumption of drugs, like city traders, high-performing bankers, lawyers.
That's true.
The media industry, the fashion industry. There's a lot of people, you know, who are inclined to engage in those activities.
I was very surprised in Germany how many lawyers are doing cocaine.
Yeah. Cocaine is the drug of the bankers and the lawyers, yeah. And the respectable people.
When you compare those cities with, you know, Amsterdam's, a part of Amsterdam being legal, it's basically the same, right? Because you get...
Well, the difference is basically being indoors or not. Like, you know, sometimes in London in the winter, it's shitty weather, it's raining, it's cold, it's gray. And you're like, why can't I have a joint at the pub, you know, like...
That's a good point.
But Amsterdam has its drawbacks too. Like in coffee shops, you can't drink alcohol. Like most of them have.
But I'm not a fan of mixing heavy alcohol with wheat though.
No, but even on beer, like sometimes, you know, for example, I would enjoy the experience of sitting in a bar with friends watching a football match with a beer and a joint. But it's impossible anywhere on earth except your house, basically. You know what
it's
I mean?
True. That's
and
true.
It's a nice experience. Like, you know, like
in it's illegal everywhere in the world.
In Italy, like, you have. Most people have pizza e birra with the football match. No? They have a pizza with a beer and invite their friends over if it's a national team or if it's a big match like Milan Inter, Milan Juve. You know, and it's nice, of course. You start watching the match, eating pizza with friends, drinking beer. Then after you eat, you're all in the living room. There's the match. You have the hash in your pockets. Why not also have a joint, you know, and watch the rest of the match with the joint? I mean, it's a good experience for me. I enjoy it. In Italy and France, a lot of people smoke in the stadium too. This I know for sure. Cause
where?
In Italy and France.
Oh, okay.
I've been to the stadium in both countries and smoked in the stadium, and it's relatively zona franca, let's say. Like, you know, there are police checking at the entrance, but...
Too high to roll one.
But they are checking for weapons, for chains, for bombs, and not checking for weed. Mm-hmm. Like, and once you get in, like, the... if you're like in the curva, near the curva, you know, those guys go in every week as the same guys. They know the policemen, they know. So those guys are there 2 hours before the match. And I mean, I was surprised. I mean, in Italy already a lot of people smoke of those guys at the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to a match in Paris to watch PSG at the Parc des Princes, it was amazing. Like there were waves of, you know, hash smell, weed smell coming, just traveling down the curva of the stadium.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Plus everyone was like jumping together, singing. It was
but
great.
Were they drinking also?
Some of them. There was some beers too, yeah.
That's
We were doing both, definitely. And the cool thing was like, so... Because I was used to Italy, and in Italy, usually there's... That's too much, huh?
Well, yeah, just put it there.
I enjoyed it because in Italy, usually the stadium, there's the home end, the curva, you know, where the home fans are. They're always in the same end. And the other end is for the away fans, so they usually sing against each other, only insults or, you know, songs covering each other, whatever. It's sort of like a battle between one curva and the other, no?
Mm-hmm.
With one being louder because it's the home one.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the Parc des Princes, it was fun because basically both the curve were home crowd, and there was just a little, like, quarter of the stadium for the away fans. So the two curvas used to sing to each other and answer to each other from one end of the stadium to the other, which I thought was quite fun, you know.
So how did organized crime got so powerful in Italy? I mean, you could say powerful, right? I mean, they had...
Yeah. Well, yeah, they run a lot of territory, let's say, control a lot of territory. Well, it's more like they were, it's not like they became powerful, they were already powerful before the Italian state was formed. I mean, the mafia is younger than the Italian state by maybe like half a century. It's not a lot, but it means that in some key areas of territory of Italy, they were there before, and they had control of the territory, they administered it, they collected taxes, they gave people jobs, they administered the land before the state arrived.
Because basically they were just families who run a region, right?
Well, it's controversial, like it's not really sure exactly what it is, but like, Southern Italy, before the Republic was formed, was mainly in the hands of the Spanish, the Bourbons, no? From Naples down to Sicily was called the Kingdom of Sicily or something like that. It belonged to Spain, basically. Mm-hmm. So what happened was the King of Spain gave a lot of these lands in Sicily, like from Naples down to Sicily in southern Italy, to important Spanish nobles, you know, as favors, as, you know, you're my friend, you helped me with this, I give you the principality of Agrigento, and mm-hmm. you will now collect the taxes from there, they will be yours, no? Then, of course, these people were like living in Madrid, in Sevilla, in Toledo, whatever. They had no interest of going to live in Agrigento, no? So they were still interested in getting the money of the taxes from those plantations, from those farms, blah, blah. So what happened was they put some local people in charge to run their plantations, collect the taxes from people who didn't pay, and give them to them. No? Then what happened was when this whole system collapsed, these people who were running the lands basically had no one to answer to, no? And they had weapons, they had wealth themselves, because working for these people, they were paid wages, they were given houses, they were given horses, they were given guns to make sure the people paid, to make sure that people didn't steal, no, from the fields, blah, blah. So these people, in a sense, became sort of local sheriffs, local town runners, town managers, mayors, if you will, whatever. And so,
like they govern.
Yes. And so then Italy, of course, being a very patriarchal, familial, based society back then, especially in the south, quite rural, quite, you know, farming based. Of course, this became a sort of patriarchal, clan-oriented thing, no? So like, oh, I'm the guy who runs the biggest plantation in the village, you know, near Palermo. So my cousin, I help him doing the roads. The cousin of my wife, he's a doctor, he will run the hospital, you know. And so that's how they started like running everything, basically, even before the Italian state was formed. Because if you were, you know, in connection, in good connection with the family, you treated them well, you had respect for them, you showed them appreciation, honor, loyalty, then they would pay you back, and in exchange they would do what they wanted, you know. They also had, you know, in some cases, when people had problems, they would say, like, I don't know, they stole my pigs, my daughter got raped, whatever. There was no judge. They went to these people, and if you were friends, you were connected because you had given them a nice present for Christmas, you paid your tax. Of course, they would give the decision, you know, more likely to you than to the other guy, you know. So it became like an exchange of favors, an exchange of protection. That's how it started, basically.
Have you watched every season from Rick and Morty?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I think, let's talk about this a little bit, because it's...
Go on.
I think the concept of Rick and Morty is so complex and so smart.
Mm.
It's kind of like mind blowing. I think every time I'm watching it when I'm high, like just to think of it, like how could the writers come up with this shit? You know, like the concept of different dimensions and all that just brings the series to a whole nother level, I think.
Yeah, I think they draw a lot from, you know, established science fiction, you know, that's been written since the 60s, and a lot of that science fiction then turned out to be actually science, where, you know, some of the things that people were writing about, imagining in the 60s now are becoming realities, like the driverless car, for example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think those guys definitely read a lot of those authors, and that's where they get a lot of their, let's say, knowledge or background, mm-hmm. you know, substance to the series. But I definitely think that they're also really inventive, and I love the series. I just think that they take way too long to write it, you know, like, because it's not that long, you know. It's like, what is it, 10 episodes per season?
Mm-hmm.
And they're taking 2 years to write one. And I mean, it's like, okay, it's excellent, don't get me wrong, but it's a long time to wait.
No, I know, that's the problem.
For a cartoon, you know, I mean, I realize, like, Game of Thrones, you have to move people with planes, you have to hire cameras, equipment, move
and tons special of effects. Stuff.
Yeah, you know, whereas this is a cartoon, you know, like 10 episodes shouldn't take 2 years, in my opinion. But.
Definitely. And what I like about it is also how it's drawn.
Mm.
Because it has this different style. And it just
reminds me a bit of Back to the Future. You know, the doctor with the hair and the...
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think Rick is...
And Marty, Morty. Remember,
yeah,
he was
yeah.
called Marty in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I never... I mean, with the professor, sure. But the one with Marty, I never thought about it like that. But it makes total sense.
Mm.
And it's basically, you know, traveling, right? It's just Back to the Future is traveling with time. Time, and then... Rick and Morty is traveling through dimensions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically the same thing. And Back in the Future, you also have different Martys from different times, right?
Yeah.
And Rick and Morty, you also have different Mortys for different dimensions.
Yeah.
Because the one that we're living now, it's actually...
Yeah, and they meet each other in different times.
Yeah,
different
I think he's living right now in the dimension where the Morty in that dimension is killed by him, I think. I think he killed the other Morty. So
he took his place. They both took their place.
Yeah.
It's quite funny what Banksy did recently at the auction house.
The self-destroying...
Yeah.
And it was actually... There was actually an error on the machine, because it was supposed to be completely destroyed and not hanging like that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm. I thought it was even better than it was hanging.
But
see, but that's, I think that's what's great about Banksy, because it's not really the technical execution. They're stencils, anyone can do a stencil, you know.
Exactly.
But it's the message that he's so clever at, like, you know.
So you like Banksy?
Yeah. Like, you know, that's what I think the modern art these days is more outside of the museums. That's what I mean. It's not what the critiques talk about.
You're right.
It's not these...
Rista,
things that are $300 million worth, you know, because like that's what Banksy does. It fulfills my second criteria. Even though the technical execution is average, anyone can do it. The message speaks immediately to whoever sees it, and it's often quite intelligent. It's often quite engaging.
Definitely.
When we went this summer to London to empty out my flat and bring all the things back to Germany and to Italy, because I decided to rent it out because I'm not living there anymore, we had to go with the car to take all the things. So driving back, we had the ferry booked at Dover to Calais in France.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way to the ferry, there was a huge Banksy, which was as tall as the house was 2 or 3 floors. And he made it on the side of the whole house. And it was a huge European flag, no, blue with the golden
with the stars.
And there was painted underneath it a guy on a ladder, taking away one star, no? And when you think about Brexit,
when you think that
you are seeing that as you exit England and entering Europe,
that's awesome.
It's so clever. No?
That's awesome, yeah.
Anyone gets it.
Like, yeah. I'm really curious on how the weed is, like, in, like, 2,000 years, because, you know, I think within 100 years, definitely within 100 years, everywhere would be legal.
Mm.
You know, at least if it's not legal, it's decriminalized.
Yeah. Right?
So if you have these big countries with all legal weed and all those products and all the research, like, I want to know, like, how... I want to see them take weed to the next level. You know, so like 1,000 years, like, what weed? Like, how do you smoke weed?
So there's this science fiction writer called Ian Banks. He was Scottish. He died a couple of years ago, unfortunately, but he writes about a sort of society like that 10,000 years from now, no? And in that society, you have glands inside your body that can, like, whenever you think of a drug, like, you know, I want the effect of weed, or I want the effect of alcohol, or I want the effect of cocaine, you just think it, and the gland inside your body creates it and pumps it into your bloodstream directly, and you start having the effect.
You think that's possible?
That's a pretty cool way of imagining it, I thought. If you had a gland, you know, in your body that was either artificially grown there or implanted there, then it's not hard to think of a release system, like, connected to your brain. That, I mean, we're talking 10,000 years from now, right? Or...
Okay, I can see that. Or at least, you know, if you don't have that connection with the brain, at least you could just push a button. It's like an app.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Okay, now I want things. I can really see that. Like, you have this artificial glands that could mimic all those drugs.
Wait.
So you have an app and you just press it.
Yeah.
And the glands, and you pay like $1.
Yeah. For every hit.
For every hit. There would be a man. I mean, if someone could make that app.
Yeah.
And that technology, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, you would make a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Okay. Thank you, man.
No worries, dude.